It's been an interesting week following Israeli news, that's for sure. I see you laughing. Yeah, for very good reason. It's hard to keep up. J.D. Vance was in Israel. Commentary between him and Bibi Netanyahu as to whether Israel is a client state of the United States of America. Both pretty much responded with the word hogwash. I'd love your take on whether Israel is a client state of the United States of America.
Well, it's not a client state in many ways. It's a partner of the United States of America. But to be fair, it's not an accident that the Trump administration sends Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner. Then the vice president comes. Then the secretary of state comes. Now we're going to have the chairman of the Joint Chiefs there. And they're all going to Israel. Now, there's a reason for that. The reason is there's a desire on the part of the Trump administration to ensure that the ceasefire holds. And there is pressure, understandable pressure on the Israeli side in response to a couple of developments. One is obvious that not just the live hostages, but the bodies of the dead hostages were to be returned. It is probably true, and there's a kind of consensus that there's probably five bodies that may not be known exactly where they are or so easily to find. But that still leaves another eight beyond which those have been turned over. 15 bodies have been turned over out of the 28. At least the Israelis are convinced there's at least eight that Hamas has access to and is basically playing games with. You know, the natural Israeli instinct in that circumstance is to come down hard on Hamas, withhold humanitarian assistance, basically impose a price. The administration is basically trying to get the Israelis to hold the line because they want to preserve the ceasefire. At the same time, the president begins to threaten Hamas publicly if they don't respond. But he's really doing that less because we're going to do something against Hamas and more because he's trying to build pressure from Turkey, Qatar, and Egypt on Hamas to deliver on this. This is just, by the way, the beginning, because this is phase one, which one might say is the most straightforward.
The easy parts, absolutely.
Yes.
The complicated parts are in part two, is the Palestinian state and the disarmament. And it just seems to me, if one thinks about it, that this was more a ceasefire agreement more than a peace agreement.
It is a ceasefire agreement, but it has the potential to become something more. And obviously, President Trump has presented it as something dramatically more. And this gets back to the heart of your first question. He sees in the first instance making sure that Israel doesn't quickly depart because it's not getting what it's supposed to get. And so that's why you have this constant stream of American visitors. To be fair, what that's really designed to do is to give Prime Minister Netanyahu an explanation for why Israel can't do more, because look, the Americans are here. It's not that, boy, the U.S. dictates what Israel will do. This is in some ways helping him have an explanation for why Israel isn't doing more.
That's an interesting take on it. Oh, it's been an interesting week. I mean, if you think about that vote in the Knesset last week, where there was initial movements made to talk about annexing portions of the West Bank. I mean, talk about a badly timed vote. Talk about shoving a finger in the face of the Americans, who are really trying their hardest to make this thing work. Well, do you think that Netanyahu is losing control over his own cabinet?
I think that he's had an issue with parts of his cabinet for a long time. And this was actually an interesting combination of the political opposition with parts of his cabinet seeing an opportunity. In his cabinet, they want annexation. His own party was pushing beforehand legislation on this, so meaning Likud. It wasn't just Ben Gavir and Smotrich. So you have people like Avigdor Lieberman, who saw this as, okay, you know, this is the kind of thing that Bibi would do to the opposition, so we're going to do this to Bibi. And Bibi couldn't hold a line on his own party. That was part of the problem.
Quite remarkable.
Yuli Edelstein voted, the vote, to put this in perspective, was 25-24, which tells you that almost everybody else abstained. So it was designed to embarrass Netanyahu, and it did that.
It certainly did. It certainly did. I'm wondering to what extent Netanyahu has run out of wriggle room. Pardon me, too many R's in that or those words. Wriggle room. In terms of the fact that Israel definitely was a bilateral, there was bilateral consensus in the United States of America a couple of years back. I think Bibi went to speak to Congress when Obama was president and burnt that consensus. He's got nowhere to go now. I mean, what Trump says has to fly.
Well, that's why I was being asked here, why could Trump do what Biden couldn't do with Bibi? And my answer was, with Biden, Bibi had the Republicans he could turn to, and he knew that they would automatically support him, and they could use this as a kind of political wedge issue. He has alienated the Democrats because of what he did in the speech to the Congress in 2015.
Yeah.
And that's still, the Democrats there still hold that against him. But the Republicans, if it's a choice between Bibi and Trump, well, you know who the Republicans are going to support. He doesn't have a political base here in the country that he can turn to create leverage on Trump. So he doesn't have that leverage. Trump has all the leverage on him. Now, to be fair to Trump, and even to be fair to Bibi from this standpoint, Trump did something that no American president has ever done.
Yeah.
He actually took part offensively in operations against Iran. Now, Biden was the first American president to actively participate in Israel's defense. In 2024, you had two different occasions where Iran fired ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and drones at Israel, and the U.S. was an active participant in terms of intercepting those. The notion, which has been part of the Israeli DNA, which is we defend ourselves by ourselves, really isn't so true anymore. Doesn't mean that Israel doesn't bear the brunt, and it's clear that Israel always wants to be in a position, we don't ask anybody else to die for us. But the fact is, under Biden, twice, the U.S. made a major commitment to help intercept what were attacks against Israel. But Trump took that a step farther, because Trump carried out a strike against Fordo, really a mountain where there was one of the most important enrichment sites.
Sure.
Isfahan, which is where they convert material from basically uranium ore into a gas, which is part of the nuclear fuel process, and also Natanz, which was the largest single place where the Iranians do their enrichment. And you know, while Israel made it safe for us to do that because they took out the air defense, the fact is Trump did it. And it might have been a one-off because he did it, and the Iranians clearly didn't want to get into a war with us, which has always been the case, something that too many American administrations have been deterred, because Iran would always say, we're going to set the region on fire if you attack us. And Republican and Democratic presidents before weren't prepared to challenge that. But Trump did. And guess what? Nothing happened. So, you know, what Trump did is do something no one had done. By the way, he sent a message to the Arab states that, okay, the Iranians have lost their impunity. Well, that's one of the reasons they're also somewhat more responsive to him right now. But it gets back to the point you were making. The point you were making is this looks much more like a ceasefire deal, getting the live hostages out, than it does like a real approach to peace, because the crux of what comes next is disarmament. If there isn't disarmament of Hamas, then Israel doesn't pull out of Gaza. Then there's no reconstruction in Gaza. The Saudis and Emiratis, by the way, have made it clear they will not invest in reconstruction in Gaza if Hamas isn't disarmed.
But the Qataris seem to be indicating that they will.
Of course they will, because they have a...
giving Hamas a lifeline.
So you have a... you don't have anybody who is actively going to go in and disarm Hamas. And the 20 points in the Trump plan make it very clear that's a central part of the plan. And there is today no mechanism for this. Now, It won't surprise you. I have a thought about how it can be done.
That was going to be the next question, is how does this play out?
Here's what I think the key is. It is interesting to me that you wouldn't normally think of the Trump administration wanting to have a Security Council resolution. I mean, I think clearly the way President Trump looks at the UN, he looks at it with...
disparaging would be a good word.
Well, I think that'd be a good word. My diplomatic euphemism is he's able to restrain his enthusiasm. But it's interesting that he's saying, and Secretary Rubio is saying, that the countries that are prepared to contribute to the International Stabilization Force feel they need a Security Council mandate. Now, the problem today is nobody has the same understanding of what this International Stabilization Force is going to do. What is its mission? What are its rules of engagement? You listen to many of the Arabs speak, Egypt, and the Jordanians, and even the Saudis will say, well, they shouldn't be responsible for law and order within Gaza. They should be responsible for protecting the perimeter, preventing smuggling, maybe helping with humanitarian assistance. But it should be Palestinian security forces that should be doing public safety and law and order. And the Egyptians have been training these forces. It is inconceivable that Palestinian security forces anytime soon can provide real public order within Gaza. So what should be the mandate for this international security, for this international stabilization force, should be law and order and protection of the Gazan public. If you really want to get Hamas to acquiesce, the way you get them to acquiesce is not through Arab pressure on them, although that can be of help. It's through making sure the Gazan public is safe enough to express their views on Hamas, which are profoundly hostile now. And Hamas, because of the way it defines itself as being organically part of the Palestinian people, the embodiment of the cause, if the public feels safe enough to be criticizing and demonstrating against Hamas, Hamas at that point will decide, okay, it makes more sense for us to lie low. We'll find a way to recoup over time. That's the surest way to get them to go along with the process of disarming. The alternative that Egypt is going to produce an all-Palestinian dialogue, which includes Hamas and all the other factions, and in that context, Hamas will agree to give up its weapons. If Hamas agrees to that, it will be for a big quid in return, which will be having a political role in Gaza.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, you can bet sooner or later
that's a tough find one.
A way to come back to control it.
Tough one.
So that for me, there's an opportunity here. I don't want to diminish the opportunity. There is an opportunity here, but not if it's going to be based on Hamas has to agree to everything.
You know, I'm listening to you talk, and I'm just thinking at the same time about what's happening in Lebanon and the disarmament discussions there, which were looking so promising for a certain period of time. The American envoy was making the right comments. President Aoun was making the right comments. And it looks like Hezbollah has just stuck its stake in the ground and said, so far no more. It's our right to retain our arms, and we're not disarming. That seems to be a really, really difficult, sticky issue in the context of the
war. It is, and it's not surprising. Look, these are groups that define themselves. The Arabic term for resistance is mukawama. They are defined by mukawama, resistance. So if you're giving up your arms, that means you're giving up resistance. Well, that means they're giving up who they are. So that's why it's not a simple proposition.
Big ask.
But in what's different in Lebanon is you actually have a government. In Gaza, you need to create an alternative. That's why you also have to get this International Stabilization Force in there. That's why you need the Board of Peace to be deployed. That's why you need this technocratic committee. So you create an alternative. In Lebanon, you have an alternative government. And while they're clearly hesitant to be taking on Hezbollah directly, what's interesting is Israel is hitting Hezbollah on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And the government... You know, you don't hear it.
It's no, nobody's saying anything. It's true. Mm.
So it's like, in effect, what they're doing is saying, okay, we're not really prepared to do it because we don't want to turn this into a civil war here. But if the Israelis are going to do it, we're not going to object. Or at least our objections will be pro forma. So it's kind of interesting. So you can ask the question, well, can you create the equivalent of that in Gaza? That's actually where the Palestinian Authority comes in. Bibi said it won't be Hamas, it won't be Palestinian Authority. It will be the Palestinian Authority.
Interesting
again,
comment.
Read the 20 points. It will be the Palestinian Authority because there isn't an alternative. But as I've been saying to the Arabs, the obligation to produce reform on the PA, which is ultimately the key to this, is on you, not on us. It's on you. You want point 19 of the 20 points talks about if reform is faithfully carried out by the Palestinian Authority, that will set the conditions for a path producing self-determination and statehood for the Palestinians. So as I've said to them, look, if you want to move towards that political horizon, the obligation is on you, not just the U.S., not just others. You have to deliver reform on the PA side, which is ultimately what is necessary. If you can't talk about a Palestinian state today, because if you did, you would have a failed state. But that doesn't mean that that shouldn't be the answer over time. I still think that two states for two peoples is still the best answer. It's just not something that can be achieved anytime soon.
I probably have a list of between 10 and 15 questions that I could very happily put to you, but I'm out of time. I'm going to ask you one more, and I'm going to just draw it up to maybe a hopeful ending, something about peace. You've been a key architect for peace efforts. What's the one thing you think both Israelis and Americans are misreading about each other right now?
That's a really good question. I think on the Israeli side, there's probably less misreading than there was before.
Interesting.
Clearly, the right wing in Israel had delusions. I can only put it that way. They had delusions that they were going to have, they'd be able to annex. And obviously, Bibi was doing nothing to discourage that. I mean, I said, 3 weeks ago, his own base, his own party, forget Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, they passed a resolution, it's time to go ahead and do annexation. He did nothing to discourage the leaders of the settlement movement who were pushing for annexation. So there clearly was a misreading. They thought that Trump would give them a blank check on that as well. And now you see what Trump is saying. And in the interview he gave with Time magazine, he went much further by sort of saying, they can't do this because then they lose their support. They lose all their American support. That was pretty blunt. So I think that was a clear misreading on the part of an important segment of Israel. On the part of the Trump administration, they may be misreading the limits of what Israel can ultimately tolerate in Gaza.
In terms of Hamas living to see another day.
The language of the Trump administration, whether it's the president or it's Vance or it's the Secretary of State, is that Hamas can't be there. But right now, the administration isn't presiding over a process that is leading that direction. Quite the contrary, because right now, Hamas is reconstituting itself in half of Gaza. And the longer the time goes on, the harder it will be to reverse the impression of Gazans that Hamas is not going anyplace. So I think that's where there may be some misreading on the administration side.
Ambassador Dennis Ross, what a privilege to have you chat to us on Chai FM this afternoon. Thank you for your time.